and gentlemen, you're listening to KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. It's Wednesday afternoon at 5 o'clock here in California, and that means that this is the almost Christmas Eve edition of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Thanks very much for tuning in to your local campus and community radio station. I know that we have listeners throughout the Sacramento Valley and in many other locations via the World Wide Web. We welcome all of you this holiday season and thank you for your continued patronage and support of this freeform radio station based in Davis, California. Here on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour, we feature interviews with poets, pundits, prognosticators, people who are interested in creativity, in making things, often fusing images together, or if not images, words, sounds, representations of culture, lives, emotions, aspirations. All of this comes together in a poetic mix every Wednesday afternoon from 5 to 6 here on KDVS. This afternoon, for instance, I'll be featuring a live interview with Ernest Hilbert. Ernest Hilbert has a brand new book of poetry out called 60 Sonnets. Well, it came out last year. And Hilbert is a very important editor. He's a poet. He is also a antiquarian bookseller out of Philadelphia. And he's agreed to be our first guest this afternoon on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. I'm about to get him on the live line. So stick around for some live radio, a conversation with Ernest Hilbert here on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour on KDVS Davis. Playing a little bit of holiday music as bumper music in between our guests. In the second half of the program, we will hear the recorded voice, a performance of Dylan Thomas reading from A Child's Christmas in Wales. We may also hear a little bit of Spike Jones this afternoon on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. My first guest this afternoon is Ernest Hilbert. Ernest Hilbert's debut collection of poetry, which came out last year, called 60 Sonnets, was described by X.J. Kennedy, who himself is an important poet and an anthologist who I respect very much. He called this book the most arresting sequence we have had since John Berryman checked out of America. Adam Kirsch wrote of Hilbert's limited edition chapbook, Aim Your Arrows at the Sun, that, like Robert Lowell, Hilbert is drawn to scenes of carnage where the true face of humanity seems to reveal itself. The Poetry Foundation writes that in his debut collection, 60 Sonnets, Hilbert establishes a variation on the sonnet form employing an intricate rhyme scheme and varied line length. A skillful practitioner of form and nuance, Hilbert shifts between delicate sonic moments and humorous narrative sequences. Ernest Hilbert's poetry has appeared in a great number of journals that you've heard of, including The New Republic, Yale Review, American Poetry Review, New Criterion, London Review, and many others. He edited the Oxford Quarterly when he was at Oxford University. He was also the poetry editor for Random House's magazine Bold Type in New York City, and more recently, the editor at Contemporary Poetry Review. Now, among other things, he's an antiquarian book dealer in Philadelphia, where he lives with his wife, but today he's taken some time to talk to us about poetry and his poetry in particular. Ernest Hilbert, welcome to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. Good to have you here, sir. So, from what I can tell from your bio, you're in this transitional period now where you've worked for years as the editor of Contemporary Poetry Review, and now you're focusing perhaps more on your own poetry as well as your work as an antiquarian book dealer. And I'm wondering if you see this as a shift that allows you to focus more on your own poetry and creativity, your work as a poet.
Yes, I think that's a good way of putting it. My day job is with a firm called Bowman Rare Books. I'm in the main headquarters in Philadelphia. Uh-huh. We also have a gallery on Madison Avenue in New York and at the Palazzo in Las Vegas. And we deal in a variety of what you might call high-end or high-spot collectible antiquarian and rare first edition books. As for the Contemporary Poetry Review, I did it for 5 years, which is a long time to do anything in the literary world.
Absolutely.
It demands so much of your time. I found it very fulfilling, as well as frustrating, as these things can be. I learned a great deal, and I got to know quite a lot of people I respect very much. And I think I shepherded quite a large number of very good essays through to publication at the Contemporary Poetry Review. So it's nice to take a little time off now and focus, as you said, more on my own poetry, on my own blog, Everse Radio, and doing other things. I'm supplying the introduction to a new series of Charles Dickens novels called the Canterbury Editions that will be coming out probably next year. So I do things like general literary work like that.
Absolutely. Well, I want to make sure to get to Everse Radio in a moment. But first, tell us a little bit about your sequence of poetry called 60 Sonnets, which was published last year. What was your goal for the book? And did you have the title 60 Sonnets in mind while you were working on the variety of components that make up this book?
Well, no. I always come to titles later. Both of books and of individual poems, and I feel they should really come naturally and sort of roll off the tongue and also encapsulate the effort to sort of symbolize the overall meaning or thrust of what is going on, if you will. I had already been publishing in magazines for many years before I started writing in this loose sonnet form of my own. It's a different sequence of rhymes, different rhyme schemes than you would find in a Spenserian or Shakespearean or Petrarchan sonnet. And I was writing a bit for music at the time. I had written an opera, a short opera, that is still performed in New York now and again, called Summer and All It Brings, with the composer Daniel Felsenfeld through the Composers Collaborative in Manhattan. And I was living in New York at the time. This is just before I moved to Philadelphia. And so I started finding myself also writing song sequences and also full-length, evening-length opera called The Last of Manhattan. And Felsenfeld wanted me to do more things in form and rhyme because he liked it was easier to set and also paced things a little bit differently. So that's when I started. And then I started sort of writing in this form. I really liked it. I tend to write in a great variety of tones, from satirical to elegiac. I write in different perspectives, first, second, and third point of view, first and point of view. And I thought that having the consistency across an entire book of roughly the same 14-line sonnet form helped to give it some cohesion and a sense of identity. I wrote many more than appear in the book, and when it was finished, it wasn't as though I simply snipped off a length and said, here's a book. It took me a long time to come around to deciding the order and the actual table of contents for that book. I have a second sequence called All of You on the Good Earth, which will be issued by the same publisher in the year 2013, which are ones that were written a little bit later in the overall period. I don't write much in that particular form anymore. I do now and again. But that was a period of about 5 years when that was my principal mode of composition, was the 14-line sonnet.
And it seems that at least most of those 5 years also overlapped with your work as an editor, first at Bold Type and especially a Contemporary Poetry Review. Did you find that your own creative processes, your ideas, were sparked by the poems that you were accepting and rejecting when working at those journals?
Here's the thing. The Bold Type magazine, I was living in New York, and although I brought in some non-Random House authors, I was generally expected to write about and interview and publish things that would help to promote authors who were published by something that fell under the umbrella of what was eventually known as Random House.
Right.
It was Bantam, Doubleday, Dell when I first started, and then the Bartleson Group absorbed Random House and its imprints and auxiliary features. So then you had Knopf and the famous series from Knopf and Modern Library and all of that. So I did Mark Strand and Kenneth Koch and quite a lot of interesting, well-known writers. But then with Contemporary Poetry Review, to be clear, I should have mentioned this before, it's a critical journal. It doesn't publish any poetry per se.
Right.
But I did interview quite a few people like, Franz Wright and W.D. Snodgrass for that journal, and I also published my own essays. But the contents of Contemporary Poetry Review are essays, reviews, even sort of types of memoirs about reading. But it's all prose is the point.
Right.
As to whether or not it actually had any direct influence, I would say the thing about a 14-line poem that rhymes and is in essentially a decasyllabic line, sometimes iambic, sometimes less so, but generally a 5-beat common measure, is you can begin to write it on the tongue or in your mind, if you will, on the trolley on the way to work, while walking down the street, while I'm doing something else. And so while I'm distracted between all these other things I'm doing, I was able to carve out the time to think on a particular topic or theme or experience and get it into a sonnet. And only when you see them completely as a book do you see the whole sort of period put together in one place. But the 14-line poem was very good. Oh, sorry, I have a cat climbing on top of my phone right now. It was something I could spend a little bit of time here and there doing in the middle of other things.
I'll remind folks that this is KDBS, and you're listening to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. My guest this afternoon is Ernest Hilbert. He is the author of a book of poetry called 60 Sonnets. He's also worked widely as an editor, as a poetry booster, as a literary critic. He is also an antiquarian book dealer living in Philadelphia, and he hosts the popular blog and video show called Everse Radio, about which we'll say more in a few minutes. Well, Ernest, if it's all right with you, we're going to take a quick musical break, and then when we come back, I'd love to hear a poem from your most recent book of poetry.
That sounds good. Thank you.
Sure. You're listening to KDVS, 90.3 FM in Davis. My name is Andy Jones, and this is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
The Linux Users Group of Davis, or LUGOD, is a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting the Linux computer operating system and other open source products as an alternative to expensive, proprietary, and monopolistic software. LUGOD meets in Davis on the first Tuesday and third Monday of each month. For more information, visit LUGOD's website at lugod.org or contact Bill Kendrick at 530-759-1019 or via email at root@lugod.org.
Welcome back to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. I have Ernest Hilbert on the live line. He's a poet whose work has been published very widely in a great number of important journals. In addition, his poems have been translated into several Nordic languages and are currently taught at a number of universities, including Columbia University, University of Pennsylvania, Sarah Lawrence, the New School, the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan, and Drexel University. We're talking today about his new book of poetry called 60 Sonnets. It came out in 2009. So, Ernest, do you have a poem there that you could share with listeners this afternoon?
Sure, I'd be happy to. This is actually the last poem in the book. It's in a section called Elegies and Laments. The book slows down a bit toward the end, a little bit less action-packed, a little bit less humorous. And I saw fit to end it with a poem called Calavera for a Friend. Now, the term Calavera might do with some explaining. It has more than one meaning, but on the Day of the Dead in Mexico, some people will write a satirical poem imagining either a friend or perhaps a famous public figure dead. So it's an elegy for a living person. It is also used to refer to a small candy skull, a sort of sugar skull, which is eaten, by which act one would be symbolically consuming death and mocking death on the Day of the Dead. When I wrote this, I didn't want it to be funny. I started realizing there was no one I would be pleased to see dead, to say the least. So it's called Calavera for a Friend. When your heart is scorched out, the unruly world will seal around you as a dark ocean behind a ship at dusk. The wake will fade and spread wider until fully unfurled. Love reserved for you will slacken. Your portion of commerce ends with the last deal you made. A stranger will take your job, buy your home, maybe wear your shirts and shoes, and the books you cherished will be thumbed by new readers. Young tourists will roam everywhere you roamed. Some small items might remain. Artifacts, footnotes, fingerprints, cufflinks, little anchors, small burrs that cling, initials carved in a tree, your name inscribed where no one will see.
Oh, that's very nice. It almost returns, you spoke of Shakespearean sonnets before, about the grand statements that Shakespeare would make, often at the end of his poems, about the extent to which his work would grant immortality to his beloved. This poem that you just read, it explores perhaps similar themes, but on a smaller scale, and looking especially at the literal representations and leavings of the dead. Very nicely done.
Thank you.
You had mentioned, in addition to Shakespeare, Spenser before and Petrarch. I'm wondering, when you were thinking about the sonnet forms, was it mostly older, established classic poets that you heard influencing you, or were there other poets writing today or in the 20th century that you could also see little remnants of in the poetry that that makes up 60 sonnets?
Well, I draw influence from a wide variety of sources, and not only poetry, in fact. But to speak on poets, the one thing I did, not to get too technical, but the structure I use is basically two sestets followed by a couplet. So it would rhyme A, B, C, A, B, C. That's the first six. And then, D, E, F, D, E, F. And then the final couplet, G, G, would round it out. That's a Shakespearean style.
Right.
And it's not easy to do because you have the end rhymes chiming very closely there. And it can sometimes feel packed or strained if you're not careful. So the clincher, if you will, I like having that because it is a summing up. And, you have the example of Shakespeare, which we can only strive to imitate and certainly not equal. Then to talk about influences in general, obviously we go back to Philip Sidney, Astro and Stella, and you think of Shakespeare's sonnets and Milton on his blindness. There's so many famous ones. But those were, a lot of those that I mentioned, those are love sequences. Just today, off the top of my head, I did a list on my blog, top five English sonnets on subjects other than love. And there are so many, of course. But it was originally a vehicle to express adoration. It was a method of courtship.
Right.
Begun in the 1200s, Giacomo de Lentini, Guido Cavalcanti. Of course, we think of Petrarch, who lends his name to the earliest fixed form that we still use today. But it was, we think of John Donne. This is love and lust and rejection and things like that. But then you think of others, like Wilfred Owen's Anthem for Doomed Youth, sort of a mass elegy for the young men killed in the First World War. As he himself would be. The Kraken by Lord Tennyson. It's actually a 15er. He adds that extra line when the Kraken wakes at the end of time. The Laurel Axe by Geoffrey Hill is a wonderful meditation upon sort of what Yves Lenoir might have called an old pile in the country, one of these beautiful old manor homes. And, of course, perhaps the most famous is Ozymandias by Percy Bysshe Shelley, which is about power and tyranny, and time, and memory. But in terms of modern, there's so many influences. Of course, I read so much poetry, but the ones that might stick out a bit more would be Auden, Robert Lowell, Elizabeth Bishop, certainly John Berryman. But there are so many that sort of fit in there in many different ways, like a jigsaw to make the book. And I hope all of it sounds like me in the end, but
right.
We all have influences, so it's best to name them. But often critics will identify something that says more about them and their preoccupations than about what you're doing. So I always take those with a grain of salt. And the comparisons that you read earlier are of course, quite flattering. And I wouldn't say they're inaccurate, but, it's not all that's going on.
Well, we all do what we can to sound like the masters, but a lot of times we'll go to masters who might have been our teachers or teachers of parents. Geoffrey Hill was a teacher of mine, and I learned a great deal about the sonnet from it wasn't a creative writing class. You might have read what he said about creative writing classes in general.
Yeah.
But yeah. But rather a close readings of great sonnets from and other sorts of poems from the 16th century to the early 20th century.
I know that he likes devotional poetry and would give readings at the Boston University chapel.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. When I was there, and I'm sure this is still true, he worked in the university professors program, and the building also held the theology offices department. right. and religion department, where actually Martin Luther King did a lot of his work as he was getting a graduate degree.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, a remarkable man, incredibly intelligent, and able to teach for an entire semester without cracking a smile once. So,
yeah, he's sort of in the division between royalists and roundheads.
Right.
He was more of a roundhead, right? Sort of a puritanical, I wouldn't really call it Protestant, but definitely sort of a stripped-down view of the decadence of beauty. Although he himself produced such incredible lines, like just the last phrase of the Laurel Acts, where he says, "The rooms of cedar and soft budding bays, tremulous boudoirs where crystals kissed in cabinets of amethyst and frost." You know, it's just so incredible.
Oh, that's wonderful. You sound like you're almost inspired to put together a new anthology of sonnets yourself. Is this something that you've
ever considered? There's so many of them out there already. Stephen Burke just did a really good one with Belknap Press Harvard, and Don Patterson has one out in England. And although if someone offered me the chance, I would certainly jump on it.
Excellent. Well, I hope that some editors are listening. All right. I'll remind folks that Ernest Hilbert is my guest, and we've been talking about sonnets. He's written a book called 60 Sonnets, which came out last year. And Ernest, I'm neglecting, because I don't see it here, to mention the publisher of your book, 60 Sonnets.
It's Red Hen Press in Los Angeles.
Yes. And
the book is available at Barnes & Noble and of course, on Amazon and select bookstores.
Excellent.
And other places online as well. I mean, it's easy to find, very easy to buy.
Now, let's dip into technology for just a moment. As someone who has worked a great deal with antiquarian books and who I'm sure has forged some individual relationships with buyers of old books and great books, how do you look at Amazon and big box stores and Barnes & Noble politically, or do you step back from those political machinations because they can't really I don't know, it's hard to know what sort of response one can have while at the same time supporting one's local independent booksellers.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out exactly what the crux of the politics would be.
Yeah.
Yes, I do believe, I mean, there are a variety of dichotomies here between buying in a bookstore and buying online.
Right.
Between buying corporate and buying local. I always give a big speech when I read in small independent bookstores and telling everyone, buy a book. Tonight, walk out of here with a book. And if you don't feel like you need one, buy one for someone's child, for your own child, for a friend. Reach over, and they're right there in front of you. Because I used to go to poetry readings at independent bookstores that closed one after another, and I'd go to the poetry reading, and at the end, I'd ask the person who had been hosting this poetry reading on a monthly basis for 10 years. I'd say, "Oh, do you know where the poetry section is?" They'd say, "Oh, I don't know. I don't work here. I don't buy books here." And I realized they've been going there and using the space for free and never once thought to actually purchase a book, and then you see it's another one down.
Right.
Philly has lost quite a lot of excellent small bookstores just in the past few years because they're always sort of on the edge of going into business anyway. It is a labor of love. I think the beauty of the Internet is it allows you to get access to a huge number of books you wouldn't otherwise be able to easily get. Because it can zero right in. ABE is the Advanced Book Exchange, and you can find anything that's available on the market in the world that someone's bothered to put in there, you can find. And that's really good if when you're looking for old, out-of-print reading copies of things that haven't been reprinted and might not turn up on Amazon. So there's that benefit of having the big sort of Amazonian presence, if you will. But then you shop in two different ways. I find that when you walk into a bookstore, you will alight on things that you weren't looking for.
Right.
So the Internet's great. You can type something into a search engine and it says, "Yes, a guy in Ohio has one for $3. Would you like to buy it?" And that's good when you know exactly what you want. But when you go into a store, there's often that wonderful sense of just finding something. There's almost a serendipity, or I don't know if I'm using the right word to capture what I'm saying here, but you see something on a shelf in a section you wouldn't normally even go into, and you pull it down, you open it up, and you read a few sentences, and you realize you have to have the book. So, but in terms of supporting local people, you know, even as one's closed, other one's open, and someone's always going to try. And I do believe I always push this. I tell people, if you're going to buy books, buy a lot of books and support everyone.
Absolutely. Well, I think that that's a good place to stop that. But I want to give you a chance to plug eVerse Radio. Could you tell us what it is and what the scope and goals of this project would be?
Sure. Okay. It's something I started when I lived in New York, and it was just a mass email that went out. And I got everyone more or less personally. It didn't have a website. And it was just a poem and the top five list I would come up with or the readers would come up with, and funny movie titles and links to things I thought were worthwhile or interesting. And I would come home from having gone to a party or a book launch party or a reading or just a bar somewhere, and I'd have four or five people's emails sort of scrawled onto napkins.
Right.
Because they had met me, and I had met them that night for the first time and just started talking to them and said, I do this thing, would you like it? And I got up to 1,500 subscribers that way. And then a few years ago, through the efforts and abilities of Paul Fleming, who also produced the show, he set up a wonderful website, and we do little video shows and radio shows, and now you can follow us through Twitter and iTunes and RSS feeds and all sorts of things, and the site looks great. And I have a few people writing for me, and we are just about to break 30,000 unique readers for the month.
That's great.
I think another 100, and we'll go. And it's a very long tail. There are thousands of posts out there. I try to post two or three things a day. A lot of it original material, like my top five English sonnets on subjects other than love, and it's my comments, and then you have access to these old poems that are in the public domain. And so what do? We do fun things. I try to keep it fun, but also very literate and serious in its own way. And the tagline, or the slogan, if you will, is, would it kill you to read a beep book? You know, I don't know. I don't want to get you an FCC violation. But, you know, it's just like, would it kill you to read a book? And so I'm always pushing books and things like that, but also other interesting things. There's music on there and funny videos. Things like that. So stop by. It's just eVerseRadio.com.
Excellent.
All one word, yeah.
eVerseRadio.com. And my intern is on a well-deserved holiday break, but I'll have her add it to your bio on the radio show for this for the website for this radio show, which is PoetryTechnology.com. And I'll see if between the listeners and my own web efforts, if I can get you those last 100.
I would really appreciate that.
All right.
One comment on technology, because, you know, a book is a form of technology.
Right.
And the book, as we know, is really only about 500 years old, which is actually quite recent. In the larger view, my wife works with objects that are 3,000 and 4,000 years old every day. She's an archaeologist. And to them, books are very recent things. And it wasn't until the invention of movable types that you really had books published the way we think of them. Before then, there were things. You had illuminated manuscripts. You had scrolls. You had written culture. There's no question about it. But not the way we think of it. So the book is a perfected technology in its way, and I see that it's already people are really enjoying the Kindle and e-readers. And I don't see these things as necessarily warring with each other. It doesn't matter to me if I read a poem on a screen or in a beautiful, beautifully crafted fine art book or in just a print-on-demand trade book. It does, I'm sure, affect your experience on some level, but you're still reading it.
Right.
And that's part of my point, because I have a small fine art press, and it's called Nini and Lion Press. And I do very limited things in interesting styles. And these are sort of hand-sewn, signed, limited books. We just did one in a faux snakeskin, like fake leather, that's kind of fun, and things like that. And with die cuts on them, and they're hand-sewn, and I like to do letterpress things. And I have a press that I'm waiting to set up in my basement once I get the basement finished. And I don't see why that can't exist side by side with the website I use to sell them, or the Twitter alerts that I put out to let people know that something's out there and they should buy this book. And it doesn't matter if they're buying the book digitally,
right,
or if they're buying the book in the printed form. Some people say they, quote, don't like clutter, unquote, which I think is crazy because I love books. I love the way they look. I love having them all over the place. But that's me. And I can see people thinking they take up too much space or they're too expensive. And those are legitimate things to think sometimes. But as long as the books and the words are still being used, it doesn't matter if they're being read on a phone or on, in a traditionally published book.
Absolutely. Well, we've been hearing the well-formed opinions of Ernest Hilbert. He is the force behind Everse Radio, which is everseradio.com. And he's also the author of the debut collection, 60 Sonnets. Ernest, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope that you'll drop me a line next time you have something big to plug, because I'd like to help you do that with this radio show.
I really do appreciate it. Thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, and happy holidays to you and your family.
And the same to you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. Thanks very much for tuning in today. Let's hear a little bit of Nat King Cole. I don't play enough Nat King Cole on this radio show. Here's a tune of his that you'll recognize. This is KDVS 90.3 FM. Davis.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. Tiny tots with their eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight. They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer really know how to fly. And so I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92. Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you.
You're listening to KDVS, 90.3 FM in Davis. My name is Dr. Andy, and this is the holiday edition of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Always for my pre-Christmas edition, I bring my son Juki down here to join me in the studio and keep a close eye on him, as people who know my family well know has to be the case with Juki in the house. I've prepared a little bit of a holiday offering, some poetry and some music. I sent an email to my old friend Spike Jones, the director. You might know him from his movies such as Where the Wild Things Are, Being John Malkovich, Adaptation. He also did the video for that great Fatboy Slim song, Weapon of Choice, that has Christopher Walken dancing and eventually flying in the abandoned lobby of a Los Angeles hotel. Have you seen this? Google, weapon of choice, or you could use some other search engine, I suppose, to see the work of Spike Jonze. So I dropped him a note today, but it reminded me that Spike Jonze, J-O-N-E-S, he spells his last name the way that I did, was one of my father's favorite musical comedians, and that Spike Jonze once put out a Christmas album. It's true. So here is a track that you're not going to hear anywhere else on the radio. It's called Nuttin' for Christmas, and it's by Spike Jonze. Here on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Let's call this technology.
I broke my back on Johnny Ten. Somebody snitched on me. I hit a frog in Sister's bed. Somebody snitched on me. I spilled some ink on Mommy's rug. I made Tommy eat a bug. Bought some gum with a penny plug. Somebody snitched on me. Chair. Somebody snitched on me. I tied a knot into the chair. Somebody snitched on me. Next year we'll be going straight. Next year we'll be good, just wait. We start now, but it's too late. Somebody snitched on me. Oh, I'm getting nothing for Christmas. Mommy and Daddy are mad.
Spike Jonze, ladies and gentlemen, with his track Nuttin' for Christmas. And if you're wondering, Nuttin' is spelt N-U-T-T-I-N apostrophe. I promised you some Dylan Thomas earlier. Let's hear now from the great reader, the great poet, as he shares with us part of A Child's Christmas in Wales. Here, on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. This is a long track, so sit back and enjoy.
One Christmas was so much like the other in those years around the Seatown corner now, out of all sound except the distant speaking of the voices I sometimes hear a moment before sleep, that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and six nights when I was 12, or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was 6. All the Christmases roll down towards the two-tongued sea like a cold and headlong moon bundling down the sky that was our street. And they stop at the rim of the ice-edged, fish-freezing waves, and I plunge my hands in the snow and bring out whatever I can find. In goes my hand into that wool-white, bell-tongued ball of holidays resting at the rim of the carol-singing sea. And out come Mrs. Prothero and the firemen. It was on the afternoon of the day of Christmas Eve, and I was in Mrs. Prothero's garden, waiting for cats with her son Jim. It was snowing. It was always snowing at Christmas. December, in my memory, as white as Lapland, although there were no reindeers. But there were cats. Patient, cold, and callous, our hands wrapped in socks, we waited to snowball the cats. Sleek and long as jaguars and horrible whiskered, spitting and snarling, they would slide and sidle over the white back garden walls, and the lynx-eyed hunters, Jim and I, fur-capped and moccasined trappers from Hudson Bay off Mumbles Road, would hurl our deadly snowballs at the green of their eyes. The wise cats never appeared. We were so still, Eskimo-footed Arctic marksmen in the muffling silence of the eternal snows, eternal ever since Wednesday, that we never heard Mrs. Prothero's first cry from her igloo at the bottom of the garden. Or if we heard it at all, it was to us like the far-off challenge of our enemy and prey, the neighbor's polar cat. But soon the voice grew louder. "Fire!" cried Mrs. Prothero. And she beat the dinner gong. And we ran down the garden with the snowballs in our arms towards the house, and smoke indeed was pouring out of the dining room, and the gong was bombolating, and Mrs. Prothero was announcing ruin like a tongue crier in Pompeii. This was better than all the cats in Wales standing on the wall in a row. We bounded into the house laden with snowballs and stopped at the open door of the smoke-filled room. Something was burning, all right. Perhaps it was Mr. Prothero, who always slept there after midday dinner with a newspaper over his face. But he was standing in the middle of the room saying, "A fine Christmas," and smacking at the smoke with a slipper. "Call the fire brigade," cried Mrs. Prothero as she beat the gong. "They won't be here," said Mr. Prothero. "It's Christmas." There was no fire to be seen, only clouds of smoke, and Mr. Prothero standing in the middle of them, waving his slipper as though he were conducting. "Do something," he said. And we threw all our snowballs into the smoke. I think we missed Mr. Prothero, and ran out of the house to the telephone box. "Let's call the police as well," Jim said, "and the ambulance, and Ernie Jenkins, he likes fires." But we only called the fire brigade. And soon the fire engine came, and three tall men in helmets brought a hose into the house, and Mr. Prothero got out just in time before they turned it on. Nobody could have had a noisier Christmas Eve. And when the firemen turned off the hose and were standing in the wet, smoky room, Jim's aunt, Miss Prothero, came downstairs and peered in at them. Jim and I waited very quietly to hear what she would say to them. She said the right thing, always. She looked at the three tall firemen in their shining helmets, standing among the smoke and cinders and dissolving snowballs, and she said, "Would you like anything to read?" Years and years ago, when I was a boy, when there were wolves in Wales, and birds the color of red flannel petticoats whisked past the harp-shaped hills, when we sang and wallowed all night and day in caves that smelt like Sunday afternoons in damp front farmhouse parlors, and we chased with the jawbones of deacons the English and the bears. Before the motor car, before the wheel, before the Duchess-faced horse, when we rode the daft and happy hills bareback, it snowed and it snowed. But here a small boy says, "It snowed last year, too. I made a snowman, and my brother knocked it down, and I knocked my brother down, and then we had tea." But that was not the same snow, I say. Our snow was not only shaken from whitewashed buckets down the sky. It came shawling out of the ground and swam and drifted out of the arms and hands and bodies of the trees. Snow grew overnight on the roofs of the houses like a pure and grandfather moss, minutely ivied the walls and settled on the postman opening the gate like a dumb, numb thunderstorm of white, torn Christmas cards. Were there postmen then, too, with sprinkling eyes and wind-cherried noses on spread, frozen feet? They crunched up to the doors and mittened on them manfully. But all that the children could hear was a ringing of bells. "You mean that the postman went rat-a-tat-tat and the doors rang? I mean that the bells that the children could hear were inside them. I only hear thunder sometimes, never bells. There were church bells, too. Inside them? No, 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 in the bat black, snow white belfries tugged by bishops and storks. And they rang their tidings over the bandaged town, over the frozen foam of the powder and ice cream hills, over the crackling sea. It seemed that all the churches boomed for joy under my window, and the weathercocks crew for Christmas on our fence. get back to the postman. They were just ordinary postmen, fond of walking and dogs and Christmas and the snow. They knocked on the doors with blue knuckles. Ours has got a black knocker. And then they stood on the white welcome mat in the little drifted porches and huffed and puffed, making ghosts with their breath, and jogged from foot to foot like small boys wanting to go out. And then the presents, and then the presents after the Christmas box. And the cold postman with a rose on his button nose tingled down the tea-tray slithered run of the chilly, glinting hill. He went in his ice-boned boots like a man on fishmonger's slabs. He wagged his bag like a frozen camel's hump, dizzily turned the corner on one foot, and by God, he was gone. Get back to the presents. There were the useful presents, engulfing mufflers of the old coach days, and mittens made for giant sloths. Zebra scarves of a substance like silky gum that could be tug-of-war down to the galoshes. Blinding tam-o-shanters like patchwork tea cozies and bunny-suited busbies and balaclavas for victims of head-shrinking tribes. From aunts who always wore wool next to the skin, there were moustached and rasping vests that made you wonder why the aunts had any skin left at all. And once I had a little crocheted nosebag from an aunt now, alas, no longer whinnying with us. And pictureless books in which small boys, though warned with quotations not to, would skate on Farmer Giles's pond and did and drowned. And books that told me everything about the wasp, except why. Go on to the useless presents. Bags of moist and many-colored jelly babies, and a folded flag and a false nose and a tram conductor's cap and a machine that punched tickets and rang a bell. Never a catapult. Once, by a mistake that no one could explain, a little hatchet. And a celluloid duck that made, when you pressed it, a most unduck-like sound. A mewing moo that an ambitious cat might make who wished to be a cow. And a painting book in which I could make the grass, the trees, the sea, and the animals any color I please. And still the dazzling sky-blue sheep are grazing in the red field under the rainbow billed and pea-green birds. Hard-boiled, toffee, fudge, and all sorts, crunches, cracknel, humbugs, glaciers, marzipan, and butter Welsh for the Welsh. And troops of bright tin soldiers who, if they could not fight, could always run. And snakes and families and happy ladders and easy hobby games for little engineers, complete with instructions. Oh, easy for Leonardo. And a whistle to make the dogs bark, to wake up the old man next door, to make him beat on the wall with his stick, to shake our picture off the wall. And a packet of cigarettes. You put one in your mouth and you stood at the corner of the street and you waited for hours in vain for an old lady to scold you for smoking a cigarette, and then with a smirk you ate it.
You're listening to KDVS, 90.3 FM in Davis. My name is Dr. Randy. That, of course, was Dylan Thomas. And this is Dr. Randy's Poetry and Technology Hour. We're celebrating in our own way Christmas. Here's a little bit more.